And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Here's what's topping the news this week. Yesterday, the Dow Jones average hit an all-time high as the price of a barrel of oil dipped to a welcome new low of $58, while the 24-hour news channels were sleuthing into the emails of smarmy new excommunicated Congressman Foley, while news from Iraq sunk to a new low and North Korea prepares to test a nuclear bomb. Things are getting almost too complex. So today, we're heading to our national parks where great news is made every day. It's all coming up when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Today, we're heading into our national parks. Thank God for our national parks. Where the elk keep bugling, bison are bracing for the first big snows, retirees are driving the high roads in their RVs, school kids are in the fields, getting their hands deep into the complexities of stream ecology. And every day, 1,000 poets put pen to paper and scribe their souls into sonnets. Anytime you find the news out there getting perhaps just a bit over the edge, and you start yelling and waving your arms at Wolf Blitzer or Bill O'Reilly, well, always keep in mind that somewhere, not too far from where you are right now, there's a national park, your public lands, that are there for you, for your friends and family, for times just like these. Following the news, we're heading up to Sequoia National Park where we talk with Paul Despain, the park's cave manager, about a sensational new complex of caves that is being explored and discovered as we speak. In segment two, this past week, Congress confirmed a new director of national parks. Mary A. Bomar takes over the management of your public lands following what some felt was a difficult few years under the previous director. To find out about what Director Bomar may bring to the park mission, we head on down to Tucson and talk with Bill Wade of the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees, a group that knows a lot about our national parks. And then, in segment three, we travel back east to the Great Smoky Mountains and talk with citizen scientist Jason Love, who invites you to join the nationwide effort to tag and track the migrating monarchs as they are now on their legendary 3,000-mile flight to warmer climes in Mexico. It's a great show coming up, and it all begins following this week's news update. So now, the news. Energy companies bid $13.86 million for the right to explore for oil on 81 tracts of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Two Canadian companies dominated the bids. FEXLP, a subsidiary of Talisman Canada, and Petro-Canada jointly bid a total of $10.47 million to win the rights to explore on 48 tracts. The new sites are west of Teshekpuk Lake and just south of the Beaufort Sea coastline, close to leases already held by the companies. Of the 5.4 million acres up for lease, 3 million were withdrawn from the public sale to comply with the federal judge's ruling that barred oil and gas exploration in an environmentally sensitive wetlands. The sale brought in far less revenues than previous sales, which totaled $222 million from the last three sales. The State of Marine Environment Report released by the United Nations Environment Program, or UNEP, warned that toxic pollution to the oceans continues to increase, and the primary problem in developed nations is due to raw sewage. Whereas the oceans had historically been considered a viable dump for sewage, it is now well documented that the oceans are now in decline as a direct result of such practices. Currently, 80 to 90% of sewage entering the oceans is raw and untreated. Threatened areas include the North Sea beds, Coral reefs in Southeast Asia, wetlands in North America, Southern and Western Africa, mangroves in many Caribbean countries, Ecuador and Colombia, and fisheries in Latin America. The report documents that the number of coastal dead zones, the result of oxygen-depleted areas, has doubled every 10 years since 1960. President Bush called for a halt to all types of destructive fishing on the high seas Tuesday and vowed to work to eliminate destructive harvesting practices such as bottom trawling that destroys whole ecosystems on the ocean's floor. Bush's memo instructs the secretaries of the State and Commerce Departments to promote sustainable fisheries and to work to oppose fishing practices that destroy the long-term natural productivity of fish stocks or habitats such as seamounts, corals, and sponge fields for short-term gain. The mandate promises that the U.S. will work with other nations and international groups to change fishing practices and create new international fishing regulatory groups as needed. Currently, Brazil, Chile, Germany, the Netherlands, South Africa, and now the U.S. have expressed support for regulating bottom trawling on the high seas. Spain, Russia, and Iceland are nations which still oppose such bans. This week, marine conservation groups and a few U.S. senators hope to persuade the United Nations to ban bottom trawling anywhere where it is not regulated. The UN negotiations began Wednesday in New York. The National Park Service has a new director, confirmed by the Senate on Friday. Mary Bomar, a British native and career Interior Department employee, was nominated by President Bush on September 6th and confirmed this past Friday. Director Bomar succeeds Fran Minella, who is stepping down for family reasons. We'll be analyzing the new director during the second segment of today's show. And finally, following on the successes of the Earth Park in Cornwall, England, a massive indoor rainforest and environmental learning center will begin construction in central Iowa. Earth Park will feature an indoor rainforest, 600,000-gallon freshwater aquarium, an exterior prairie and wetlands exhibits. The main dome will enshrine 4 acres under a 150-foot-tall canopy. The new Earth Park is designed to be one of the world's greatest classrooms, and through that classroom, visitors will learn much more than awareness and appreciation. They will learn how to take action as stewards. We'll be featuring a discussion of Earth Park on next week's Wild Side News. And that's the news. And a few reminders. Now, I happen to know there are literally hundreds of new listeners to the Wild Side News. First, thanks for tuning in. And be prepared for an amazing diversity of topics each week that reflect the grand diversity of nature in our world. Now, if you haven't yet taken a look around the Wild Side News website, be sure to visit the archives, which you can access from the front page, as well as reviewing our most recent shows. We also have featured collections about animals, saving the planet, recreation, and art. And what you're going to discover is that the world's most amazing advocates for nature and sustainability, protection of the wonder, come here each week and share their voices. Now, you can listen anytime from anywhere in the world. It's great to have you joining our network. Tell your friends. Spread the word. The Wild Side News is catching on. If we are to find the common will to unite on a global basis to restructure our dreams of how we're to live together, we must come together and talk. That's what we do each week. I look forward to a lot of journeys together in the weeks and months ahead. So let's get on to today's focus on our national parks. Fall is in the air, and one of the grand places to visit at this time of the year is one of the legendary national parks in the American park system, Sequoia National Park in California, known for its extraordinary trees, legendary Sequoia trees. But there's another thing happening in Sequoia right now that I think a lot of people weren't that aware of, but it's making big-time news. And joining us now from Sequoia National Park is Joel Despain. Joel, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
Well, now, you have a unique title for Sequoia National Park. Tell us what you do.
I'm the cave management specialist here at the National Parks.
And that would suggest that there's a reason for you to have that title. Sequoia has caves.
Indeed. In fact, we have actually about 240 caves known here at the two national parks. That includes the longest cave in California and a number of the other longest caves in the state.
So what does a cave manager do? Are you actively pursuing caves? Do you do cave research? What's involved in your day-to-day?
Yes, I think of what we do is really sort of having two components. One is protection and management. We put cave gates on sensitive caves. We issue permits for cave visits. We do restoration work in our commercial cave here at the park. And then the other half of what we do is cave research. We research the variety of resources that are found in caves, whether those are mineralogical, hydrological, animals, cave wildlife, lots of unique species. So those sorts of things are what keep us busy.
Part of that ongoing research is the quest for new caves, and apparently there are groups that assist you on an amateur basis. That is a lead-in to today's story. Describe what has happened in the last few months.
Late in August, a group of four cave volunteers for the park, affiliated with the Cave Research Foundation, did discover a significant new cave here in Sequoia and Kings Canyon. Now, we do find new caves fairly often, but most of the time they're 20, 30, 40, 50 feet long, pretty short, and aren't particularly compelling, don't really contain that many interesting features. This new cave, which has been called Ursa Minor, is quite different. It features very large rooms, large passageways, beautiful cave formations. We already know that there's a whole host of cave-adapted animals inside the cave. There are clearly significant animal remains inside the cave that might be of some age. And so we've really found a very significant new cave here in the two parks this time around.
I've done a little research on how the cave was discovered, and that's quite an interesting story all by itself.
The cave was found, by a group of people who were looking for caves. We have an ongoing park-approved research project here with the Cave Research Foundation folks. And they actually were doing small-scale excavations. They were digging in likely places where they thought they might be able to access the cave. And, of course, that requires some careful thought about the geology of the area, the hydrology of the area, and where a cave might be hidden. And even combined with that, though, they certainly got lucky to find such a significant and nice cave as Ursa Minor.
Mm-hmm. Well, from what I understand, the clue was an opening the size of a softball. Let's take it from there.
The opening was about softball size, and Scott McBride, a caver from Central California, he had a flashlight along, and he could look through that hole and see back a ways. The number of feet, it was dark. And also, that hole had a particular shape to it, one that really indicated the type of solutional erosion that is how cave passages form. And so he thought it looked good right off the bat. And then the cavers spent a number of hours, so three or so, they made one trip back to get some more equipment and came back again for some more time to open up the cave and to allow access. And then immediately the entrance does go into a rappel, so they also had to get a rope and do that in order to enter the cave.
What was their first sense of the significance of this cave?
They were immediately excited and immediately realized that it was significant. As you go down the rope from the entrance that they opened up, you're in a nice cave passage, maybe 8 feet tall, 4 feet wide. It just is very pleasant, sort of, you know, body-sized passage or so. And then you suddenly go around a corner while you're still on rope, and you come out into the wall of a canyon that's 75 feet tall and 30 feet wide.
Wow.
And you can look off into blackness in one direction that's framed by these stalactites and other cave formations. So even on the rappel in, you realize that this is something quite significant.
I'd almost think you'd be afraid to enter in the sense that everywhere you step, there's wonder.
In a sense, there is. And these guys, I must say, did do a very good job on their first entry about being really careful about where they walked. You'll find that particularly these days, and particularly with newly discovered caves, that most people in the caving community are kind of aware of how they need to behave. Everyone walks in a single file line. You don't just wander over to features. You look very carefully at where your feet are placed. You make big efforts to not transport or move sediments and dirt back and forth from areas that are muddy to areas that have nice sparkling cave formations. Now we've actually gone in and defined trails. We have routes we want people to follow through the cave that are more robust and that will ensure that we do the absolute minimal damage and disturbance possible.
Well, with this kind of historical perspective on how the cave was discovered, now let's talk about what you have discovered. All reports are that it's a spectacular find.
It's a beautiful cave. The word I keep coming back to is aesthetic. It's just got beautiful shapes and forms. The rooms are large, which is unusual around here. A lot of our caves have many small, narrow, meandering passages. These are big, roomy spaces, and across all of these spaces, you just have sparkling floors that just glisten under your light. And hanging from the ceiling are long drapery and curtain-type formations that are very pretty. One of the rooms has a very large lake that sort of is divided into two lobes that's probably almost 100 feet across, and it's just a beautiful blue water down inside this lake. It is a seasonal lake. It's not completely full this time of the year. And other rooms have just beautiful displays of cave formations, beautiful pools, and wonderful things hanging from the ceiling. It's just a very pleasing, beautiful place.
Well, it's a large cave.
Large in terms of passage size. It's not a very long cave yet.
You've so far identified about 1,000 feet, but have you reached the end point yet?
We definitely have not. There are several places where cave passages continue, we can tell. And we've not chosen to follow those at this time, pending some good evaluation of what we already have. And we're trying to make sure we have everything well taken care of for what we've already seen before we go off into uncharted areas.
Can you give us a sense of the nature of the structure of the cave? I know that it has a series of rooms.
Yeah, it does have a series of rooms. They're essentially sort of two very large rooms sort of right off the bat. And from the first room down to sort of a lower right-hand side, there are some pits, some other rope drops, that area remains unexplored. To the left of that first room, there's a side passage that has many beautiful cave pearls in it. Then from the second room is the room that has the lake. From there are also a couple of side passages. One goes up to some upper back rooms that are very pretty, and another one goes to a climb, an area where the passage goes vertically, where we need to do some climbing to reach what is clearly an upper-level continuation.
Any evidence of existing animal life in the cave, which is always an exciting arena?
Yes. We also recently here at the National Parks completed a inventory of the wildlife living in Park Cave. And we actually were very surprised and pleased to realize that we had a whole series of new species, many of which were cave-adapted. And it appears that three of these new species of cave-adapted animals have been seen in this new cave. So we already know that the cave is significant in that it contains species that are endemic to the park and to the cave systems of the park.
Mm-hmm.
And very likely, with more research, we may very well find species that are unique to this cave. And that's a pretty common thing here we've begun to realize, that a lot of our larger park caves do have their own unique species.
In terms of the animals that you find inside of a cave, they must enter from the outside. They would have to. Any idea of how long they've been there, or even sort of cross-pollination between caves of a similar species, which would indicate some sort of connection?
There are a lot of possibilities for how these animals have come to be adapted to the park caves and to be in the park caves. And, you know, sometimes you can look at the individual animal and figure some of these things out. For instance, some of the animals in park caves, these animals seem to be using caves as a refuge. These are animals that whose closest relatives are found to the north in climates that are currently cooler and wetter, and in that sense more similar to the way the climate has been here in the past. Caves are also a cooler and wetter climate, and so compared to the way things are here currently. And so the cave environment can be a natural refuge for animals that are adapted to a little bit different climate than we have here currently. But we also have animals here where we have a surface species, and then in a series of caves, each cave has its own unique species that's adapted inside the cave that's related to the surface species. In other words, it's clear that the surface species had traveled into these different caves, populations developed in those caves, and unique species grew out of each of those populations in each of those caves. So it can happen in a variety of ways that the evolutionary process takes place and these animals become either isolated unique species or unique species with relatives relatively close at hand.
Well, in terms of the species that you've found so far, give us an indication of what they are.
In the new cave, we have a Striuridae millipede, a lithobiomorph centipede, which is a predator, and then also potentially a Calcina harvestman, which is a sort of a, like a spider but with a single body instead of two that most spiders have, like a daddy long legs.
Mm-hmm. Now, in many cases, cave species are albino and blind. Is that the case here?
It is the case here. Albino isn't really quite the right term. You know, that's a specific genetic situation.
That's true.
In this case, the entire species has lost its pigmentation, lost their eyes. They have elongated appendages quite often. And they also actually tend to have a very different sort of lifestyle. They tend to have fewer young at a given time and to live quite a bit longer than their surface-dwelling relatives.
Hmm.
And those are all adaptations to a low-energy environment.
How many species have you identified or found?
Actually,
let's say, discovered so far?
Mm-hmm. Total is 31.
Oh, that's
a lot. 31 new species of cave invertebrates we've found in the park caves in the past several years as the project's been going on.
There must be a sort of this incestuous feeding on each other. It's a closed environment.
Exactly, yes. And some of these animals are cannibalistic, so sometimes they'll even eat some of their own kind. And these are small communities. There's only a handful of species in each of these different caves. And so we are finding animals that are at all different parts of the food chain, and they definitely do prey upon each other.
Now, you also have a big lake, so have you had a chance to actually go underwater?
We have not. And that may be something we'll be doing in the future. The lake's pretty delicate. There's a lot of these cave formations lining its walls and bottom and things. But some diving in there may be appropriate in the future.
Of course, you could probably use some underwater viewing devices. I imagine.
Potentially so. Although we'd have to, anything like that, we'd have to take into the cave, which could be a little tricky.
Yeah. Well, let's talk also about this process of mapping. Of course, that's going to be a big part of this. What's involved? I mean, there's so many new technologies now. Probably things are really advancing nicely in that direction.
You know, we're still pretty much using 16th century technology, I hate to say.
My first thought was, well, this is going to be so much easier because of GPS, but probably GPS doesn't work under those situations.
It does not work underground because you can't really receive satellite signaling.
So you're back to ropes and other forms.
We use a tape, you know, a measuring tape, a compass, and a clinometer. And we make a series of straight line shots through the cave from point to point and record that data for each of those, and then that we create sort of a framework. And then from there, an individual with a lot of experience does a detailed drawing using standardized symbols from a legend to represent the cave's varied features.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, things like laser rangefinders are coming in big now, and they're already being quite helpful. In fact, we have used some of those on the survey at IRSA. And I probably one day we'll be able to enter all the data into a PDA and have it just beautifully plot the cave for us as we go. But we're just not quite there yet in terms of compact size, reasonable price, and robust enough electronics. But it's close.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these things are starting to be used in cave surveys now.
How long do you figure it's going to take you to survey this particular cave?
Well, to be honest, we're going slow right now. We've not quite surveyed everything that we've seen. We want to get that done. And I expect that will be completed this fall within the next month. Beyond that, it will just depend how long the cave is and how much more we find.
I'm curious. I'm a person who's intrigued with wonder and always liked that, the first new experience. What was it like for you personally as you entered this cave and suddenly realized you were in a place that perhaps, I don't know if you have any indication whether or not humans have ever been inside this cave, but perhaps no human has ever seen before?
We're pretty sure that there has not been anyone inside the cave before. There's still places where there are a lot of discoveries going on, you know. But for your average person to go somewhere where no one else has ever been, that's a rare thing. You know, unless you're an astronaut or a deep sea diver or something, that just doesn't happen every day.
Mm.
And it's really a big part of what caving is about and why caving, I think, is compelling to people, because you can go somewhere where no one has ever been, where you have no idea what you're going to find around the corner. And this cave was a big thrill in that way, because it was just immediately beautiful and big and compelling. The guys who had found it, you know, called me right away to tell me what they found. And these are experienced cavers. These guys, you know, they've been in a lot of caves, they've seen a lot of caves. And I could tell just from their excitement that this was something quite significant. And I went the next day.
Yeah.
I immediately wanted to see what it was they had seen and what had left them in such a pleased state.
As the cave manager, it's sort of, I can imagine it's almost like, okay, stand back, this is my realm.
it's sort of like, I've got a job to do and I'm excited to do it.
That's great.
It was a real good day at the office, as I say with my assistant.
Yeah, for sure. as you go into this cave, give me some of your aha moments. What really caught your attention? Where did you say, oh my gosh, that is sensational?
Well, I think for me, definitely that first entrance rappel. Like I said, you go into the entrance and it's a, you know, a nice little cave passage. It seems, oh, this is great. And then you come around the corner on the rope and it's like, holy cow. My jaw dropped when I looked off into the darkness from my perch up high on the wall into that 75-foot-tall passage going off into the mountain. I was just right off the bat there very, very taken aback and sort of realized why these guys were excited. Other things that struck me early on were the really beautiful floors. The calcite crystals that are found in the cave formations, found in the flowstones, are really large and particularly sparkly in this cave. And so the floors are just beautiful. The lake was also very exciting and just really impressive to see. Also the bones. And right there where you get off the rope as you come into the cave, there's a slope there where we also immediately found some of these cave-adapted animals. And so really just within the first half an hour, I was excited in a number of different ways and really feeling like we had a really significant find in our hands.
Now, did I hear you say bones?
Yes. There are clearly animals that have died in the cave, including one that's quite large. The name of the cave, Ursa Minor, to a certain extent, came from this because the animal resembles a bear.
Hmm.
We don't really know if it is a bear yet, and we'll have to, hopefully we'll have a paleontologist in there this fall to take a look at that for us.
Mm, that could be very interesting.
And there are bones in a number of other locations in the cave, too, that may very well be quite ancient.
Now, how is this going to affect our knowledge of cave formation? And why don't you give us a short version of how a cave like this is formed, and then how this may help advance the science?
Naturally, water under the ground is a little bit acidic. And this mostly comes from chemical processes in the soil. And acidic water, just a little bit acidic, I mean, less acidic than your glass of tea, actually has the ability to dissolve certain types of rock. And the most common type of rock people associate that with is limestone. And whenever you get limestone, you get sinkholes and springs and caves because of the way that water can erode this rock. Well, here in the Sierra Nevada, we have a little bit different version of the limestone. Here the rock is marble, which is beautiful rock, and it's also just the metamorphosed version of limestone. It's very much the same chemically as limestone. And so it erodes in the same way. Caves form by water moving underground, but that water is tied to surface streams. Caves end where springs form, where the water returns to the surface. Because of that, caves are closely tied to the landscape around them. And the elevation of a cave passage is determined by the landscape around them and by the elevation of the surface streams around them. So when you have an old cave, a big cave with multiple levels and such, that cave actually can give you a glimpse into geologic history. Here in the Sierra Nevada, the history of part caves actually can tell us a lot about the history of the mountain range. And part caves have been used to do this sort of work in the past, and Ursa Minor is going to be a great new place to do that sort of work.
Well, of course, now everybody wants to know, is the public ever going to see this cave in person?
You know, that's not really a question I can answer at all at this point. I mean, I think the cave is in a remote and isolated canyon. It does have a vertical entrance. I mean, there are a lot of challenges there. But really, you know, here at the National Parks, we've got a job, first of all, to figure out what we've got, to do a good inventory of the cave, to get good photographs of it, to understand the biology of it, to document its features. Once we know what we've got, then we'll go through a process of thinking about what's best for the cave and best for the park. You know, and that'll be a planning process and maybe part of an upcoming cave management plan for the park. And, you know, through that whole process, we'll be talking to local people and anyone who's interested, people who are cave enthusiasts for sure. And from that point on, we'll be deciding a course of action long term. We won't make any snap decisions about what we're going to do with this cave. We'll go through a long process and let people comment and let them be involved.
How often are you able to actually head into this cave?
We're going, trips into the cave are only when there's a good purpose to go, and we try to get a lot done. Every entry into the cave could potentially cause some damage or disturbance that's not necessary. So we are going when we've typically got some of our cave volunteers around. There's just myself and one other person on our staff, and we're more efficient when we have more people. So when those folks are available and we've got a specific task at hand, then we'll go into the cave and do some more survey work, do some work on the trails, getting that well lined out, and things like that. The next big project will be week after next, and that's when we're going to put a gate on the cave.
Hmm.
We're actually going to go ahead and, at that time, we'll restore the entrance to that same size, that softball-sized hole that it was at originally, in order to keep the same airflow and climate and such inside the cave.
Interesting.
And then we'll make a removable component of the gate so that people can enter, but then the gate will be in place so that we can secure the cave.
Oh, very interesting. So you have to keep the climate the same.
Yep.
I suppose you've done some extensive monitoring on the humidity and temperatures and things of that nature.
We're just starting to do that at Ursa Minor. In fact, we've just been having a few little problems with that data logger. but we have done it for a number of other park caves, and we know that caves can often be very sensitive to climatic changes, and opening an entrance is one way to do that. Mm-hmm. You can dry things out is what would be our primary concern here.
Well, Joel, you're a lucky guy to be able to have access to such extraordinary wonder and be one of the first people to see such.
Well, thank you very much. I do like my job, and we certainly hope we very much do right by this cave.
Now, for people who want to follow this story, which will be emerging for the history of the National Park System onward and forward, what's the best way for them to find out more and follow the story?
You can check our park website, or to be honest, you can feel free to contact me at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park. Do you have specific questions? Or things you want to know about, I'm at JOEL_DESPAIN@nps.gov.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking with you, Joel.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to speak with you, too, and it was a pleasure.
Our national parks are an endless natural treasury of wonder, or at least that's what we hope. The pressures have been building to change the nature of our national park system. This last week, Congress confirmed a new National Parks Director. And a lot of people are wondering what Mary Bomar will bring to the legacy of our national park heritage. We'll talk with someone who's given his life to that legacy and get his views on where we're going. So, don't go away.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The National Park System comprises 390 areas covering more than 84 million acres in every state. These areas include national parks, monuments, battlefields, military parks, historical parks, history sites, lakeshores, seashores, recreation areas, scenic rivers and trails, and the White House. There are approximately 20,000 permanent, temporary, and seasonal professionals who work for the National Park Service and over 125,000 people volunteer in parks each year. Nearly 300 million people come to the national parks. It costs close to $2.5 billion a year to operate. It's a big job. We just hired a new boss. What's she facing? We find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. This last week, the Senate confirmed Mary Bomar as the new director of the National Park Service. This is a very political year, and it seems as if no matter what happens, things become political. And certainly the issue of national parks have become politicized because many people consider the future of national parks to be challenged by certain decisions that are coming from the political arena. So it's very important to get a sense of what this new appointment may portend for the future of national parks. We're now going to talk with someone who certainly has an interest in the future of national parks. This is Bill Wade. He's the Executive Council Chairman of the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees. Bill, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you for asking me.
First of all, for people who aren't familiar with the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees, tell us about your mission and your agenda.
Okay, well, we started our organization in May of 2003 in response to what we perceived as some significant threats and assaults against the National Park System and the National Park Service. And we've grown now to where we're just over 540 members, all former National Park Service employees. Our mission basically is to advocate for the protection of the national park system as it was originally intended by the Organic Act of 1916, which established the National Park Service. And we do that through public information. We've been asked a number of times to testify before committees in the Congress, and just generally to be able to try to inform the public about issues that are relevant to the national park system and what our concerns might be about those, given that we estimate we've got collectively something over 16,000 years of experience in managing national park areas.
And that's why we're talking with you. Let's talk about some of the main issues that you have been concerned about and that really drove the coalition to come together.
Under former Secretary Gail Norton and now former Director Fran Minella, there were a number of concerns, really. A number of the decisions that they were making and issues that they were attempting to carry out, we felt were diminishing the values and benefits for which the national parks were established. These kinds of things ranged from trying to reduce the water flow, for instance, through Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park, which would have materially changed the ecosystem there. Certainly the snowmobile issue in Yellowstone National Park is one that we've been very concerned about and which still has not been resolved. They're in their fourth environmental impact statement now, and that will be one of the issues that will be facing the new director as she starts into her tenure. There are issues of air quality, relaxing air quality standards that are affecting national parks. Perhaps one of the biggest ones recently that we took on was the attempt by the Department of Interior to hijack the management policies of the National Park Service and significantly change those in ways that would have increased the potential for all kinds of additional motorized recreational vehicles to potentially run rampant through national parks. Things like off-highway vehicles, snowmobiles, of course, and personal watercraft in the water areas. That particular one seems to have successfully been beaten back now, and the management policies that were just recently approved are acceptable and much more like the original policies that go back to, or the more recent policies that go back to, the year 2001. So we're pretty satisfied with that. We've met that challenge and managed to succeed, I think, in making sure that there wasn't significant damage potentially caused by these management policies. But there are a number of these issues that are continuing, like the snowmobiles. I just read this morning, as a matter of fact, that Congressman Pierce has introduced. He's the National Parks Committee chair on the House side, and that he has introduced legislation that would authorize the state to claim all kinds of rights of way through public lands, including national parks. And I don't know yet what the ramification of all of that's going to be, but it sounds significant and like there could be some serious impacts as a result of this if it does pass. So I'm sure we'll be looking into that in more detail and doing what we need to do to try to either get it modified or make sure that it doesn't pass the Congress.
I think the one thing that I'm prepared to say is the fact that this administration utilizes all sorts of unique techniques to try to, as you use the term hijacking, for example, the management policies, which is one of the ways in which they change the direction without having to go through legislative processes. And that background manipulation seems to be part of their process of changing how parks are managed and their purpose. It feels as if Congressman Pierce's efforts to go back to a states' rights issue on public lands, including national parks, seems to be another attempt at inroads into park management from the outside. And so perhaps here we go again. Now let's talk about Mary Bulmar. One of the things that we do know about her, she is a national park person. That is to your advantage, I have to imagine.
Well, I do know Mary. I've not worked with her real closely, but she and I have crossed paths a number of times during the years that before I retired. She did come up through what we call the administration ranks. That is to say, she worked as a chief of administration in a couple of parks and worked her way up to where she became the first superintendent, for instance, of the Oklahoma Memorial, which is a very tough job, very political in the sense that she had to coordinate with a number of entities there in establishing that and attempting to carry out its mission. She served for a while as the acting superintendent of Rocky Mountain National Park, and then she went to Independence National Historic Park, where she became superintendent and again was immersed in very intense local politics as well as national politics having to do with the management of that area, particularly during a time when they were grappling with issues of security following 9/11, and there was also a lot of construction that had finally come into phase to upgrade some of the facilities and preserve some of the historical structures there at Independence. From there, she progressed to become the regional director of the Northeast region, which, of course, includes Independence and a lot of other areas. And there have been many things going on in that region, as there are in all of them, but she seems to have handled those quite well. She seems to be very effective in handling the political issues, and as you alluded to, we think that it's a very, very significant advantage that she is a park, National Park Service career professional. She has a lot more experience in carrying out things related to the national park system than did her predecessor, Fran Minella, for instance. And from what I'm hearing, there's a very strong outburst of new motivation, new energy, I guess, good feelings from within the ranks of the National Park Service employees that one of their own, as it were, has ascended again, once again, to the directorship of the National Park Service. Many of the National Park Service directors have come from the ranks and have ascended up through the career avenues in the National Park System. But certainly Fran Minella did not have that, and so I think everyone is looking forward very positively to Mary taking the reins of the National Park Service.
People who spend time with the people of the national parks, the employees, the interpreters, the rangers, the researchers, the maintenance folks, you know, it really becomes a family. It's a terrific opportunity, and there's so many great people in the national parks. I have to believe that having really spent time in the parks, particularly in a place like Rocky Mountain National Park, that spirit, she has to be part of that. Nevertheless, it is a very powerful political position. Are there any indications about her feelings about privatization, partnerships, and expanding that in national parks, which leads to some of the other issues?
There are some indications. I know that from, you know, the areas that she worked in, like Oklahoma Memorial and Independence in particular, as well as overseeing a number of the areas in the Northeast, that she's very supportive of the concepts of partnerships. She recognizes the need for partnering with a number of different entities. We hope, though, that she has a little bit different perspective about that than her predecessor does, because we felt that, and still feel, that unfortunately the whole concept of partnering and privatization is moving forward to the exclusion, I guess, of effective, professional, career-oriented management to the national park system, and, for instance, the incorporation of good science and that sort of thing to decisions. We're concerned that, for instance, over the last few years, the employees of the National Park System have their professional judgment and their experience has been largely ignored and disrespected. and they have felt very much that way. The morale of the employees of the National Park System over the last few years is lower than anybody can remember, for perhaps as much as the last 50 years in the memory of some of our members, for instance. And so I do believe that she will restore some of that motivation. She will value the career professionalism and expertise of the employees. I believe she will value science and scientific judgment and research more in decisions of the Park Service. And I think she'll view the partnerships issue a little differently than her predecessor did, in the sense that she will, I hope anyway, recognize that the value of these partnerships should be to provide a margin of excellence rather than to take over what ought to be, in fact, inherent governmental responsibility for managing the public interest in national parks. Those are things that should not be turned over to nonprofits or to private entities, and that's the way the trend has been going, and I'm hopeful that she will see that differently and recognize there's a need for partnerships. And, you know, we've been, the National Park Service has had private partners for years. I mean, all of the concessions in the national parks are operated by private entities, and that's the way it should be, but there are certainly functions within the National Park Service that should be retained in the public interest and not turned over to private entities, and I hope that she'll see it that way.
The expansion of partnerships has been certainly an issue over the last number of years, and as an example, part of this has to do with partnering with corporations, and there's nothing wrong with that. Ford, for example, has been a wonderful partner with the parks, but there becomes a point where perhaps it goes too far. I think one of the things that people enjoy about going to national parks is when you go there, you get the sense that you're in a national park, not in a playground, or not a Disneyland. There's been some movement in terms of, for example, renaming trails or facilities after a corporation. You could have like a Sony Bridle Veil Falls trail. I'm making that up, but I'm saying that is one of the issues.
Well, that's part of it, for sure. I mean, any time that you entertain arrangements or agreements with certainly commercial entities and private entities, and to some cases even nonprofit and philanthropic entities, there's always a quid pro quo. If they're going to do something for the National Park Service, they logically want something in return for it. And a certain amount of recognition and a certain amount of, you know, working closely with them is definitely appropriate, but there becomes a limit when I think the parks lose that specialness that we have come we've come used to according to the parks. And like you say, we would not want to go into Yosemite National Park, for instance, and go into an auditorium and have an interpreter stand up at the podium to deliver an orientation or an interpretation program and have a big banner behind the person on the wall saying this program is brought to you by such and such.
Right.
I just think that sort of thing is out of place. And the more that we move in that direction, the less public the parks become and the more private they are in many different ways. And so I think, again, there's a very definite place for certain kinds of private activities that are going on in parks, concessions and that sort of thing. There's certainly a place for philanthropic and other partner kinds of things, but we need to make sure that they don't interfere with the specialness that the parks have built up over the last 90 plus years, and that the parks do remain public, that they do remain national. And I think the only way to do that is to continue to make sure that public money and public entities and career professionals continue to provide the primary way of managing national parks.
part of the decline of the morale has to do with the lack of funding. Things are, in many cases, falling apart, and they're just not being repaired. It's a huge, just maintaining national parks is a huge endeavor. It takes a lot of money, and unfortunately, that money just doesn't seem to be there right now, and there's a backlog. What can you tell us about, maybe it's your wish or your thoughts, in terms of Mary Bomar, about her fire to get that funding?
Well, you're absolutely correct. A lot of what's driving even some of these partnerships and attempts to provide more help for the parks through commercial entities and philanthropic organizations and so forth is the fact that they're currently underfunded, not only just in terms of the maintenance backlog, which continues to increase despite promises that were made by President Bush throughout his term so far. That maintenance backlog does not seem to be going down, and in fact it seems like it's going up. But also the annual day-to-day operating funds that are needed at the park level just to continue to have permanent positions filled, critical ones, for instance, that might be resource specialist oriented, to be able to do the annual ongoing maintenance and preventive maintenance and to provide both visitor and resource protection and the interpretive programs. All of that is going down, and I think the National Parks Conservation Association estimated just recently that the annual operating deficit in the national park system in all the parks is somewhere around $800 million now. So, you know, that's going to be a problem in the future, and I don't know what the answer is there, whether there needs to be consideration to actually instituting some closures of certain parts of parks during certain days of the week or certain months of the year in order to begin to save some of that money and put the money that is available to the higher priority things that are going on, because it doesn't seem like there's much probability, given the world situation and the country's economic situation, that there's going to be much relief in the immediate future in terms of the budget situation. It certainly is an issue of national priority, and I guess if enough citizens of this country began to speak out that about their concerns of deteriorating conditions and deteriorating protection of resources in national parks, then perhaps Congress would get the message and figure out where to get some additional money so that parks don't continue to spiral down. And we end up, you know, the biggest fear, of course, or the biggest potential consequence is that we begin to lose valuable resources, either historic structures that once they get to a certain point, you can rehabilitate them and you can rebuild them, but they're no longer historic. They're replicas or something like that. And if we lose precious, rare, or threatened species because we haven't been able to provide enough protection patrols and poaching increases, for instance. So there are all kinds of problems that face, that are going to face Mary Bomar, and I know that she, perhaps even more than her predecessor, she's going to be knowledgeable about those, she's going to be concerned about those. And I don't have any doubt that she will fight to try to overcome some of these operating deficiencies and so forth. But in the end, it's on the shoulders of the Congress largely. Certainly the administration makes its recommendations and makes its requests for money. So that's the immediate hurdle. But it's up to Congress to decide whether or not to give the Park Service the money it needs. And in my judgment, the only way that's probably going to be accomplished is that the American public demonstrates that that's one of its priorities.
You know, it's interesting how quickly the opinions start coming out. I, for example, read somewhere, which I don't recall right now, that people are suggesting that Mary Bomar may be in favor of continued snowmobile use in Yellowstone. That probably may be one of the first issues that she's going to have to be confronted with. Are you hearing something similar, that she seems to be in favor of continued snowmobile use?
Well, I think where that is coming from is that she did make a statement at her confirmation hearing in response to a question from one of the senators. She did make a statement that she understood that the current levels of snowmobile use in Yellowstone were not leading to or resulting in unacceptable impacts, and that statement is kind of the statement that has been used by the previous director and the people in the Department of Interior when questioned about the snowmobile use in Yellowstone. And I think that she basically was briefed to use the same statement during her confirmation hearing. I am not yet willing to suggest that she is going to stand by that, or that she's not going to get more knowledgeable and make a determination based on her own judgment and based on the facts and based on the science that's presented to her as she does learn more about it. I think that if the truth were known, she probably would lean, you know, toward making absolute sure that the resources of the world's first national park aren't impaired in any way by snowmobiles or anything else, not unlike the fact that I'm sure that while she managed Independence National Historic Park, which arguably on the cultural and historical area side held the same status and the same level of reverence that Yellowstone did on the natural side, that she wouldn't have wanted anything to impact that place. And so I think that as she becomes more knowledgeable, she will form her own judgment and her own opinion. But it's definitely one of those factors that's going to be facing her within the first few months of her directorship. And I think she'll consider all sides and make a judgment accordingly.
Hopefully, as you say, she'll rely on the science, because there's been a lot of professionals who have come out with real science on that issue.
Well, the science has been pretty firm over the last 12 years since this controversy started, that there definitely are impacts. And for instance, some of the information that's coming out of Yellowstone right now indicates that even with the reduced numbers over the last two seasons, that there still is that the noise situation is still exceeding the thresholds that were established by the National Park Service, and that at certain times and in certain places, the carbon monoxide levels, for instance, as well as other pollutants, are exceeding those thresholds. So it's really not accurate to say that there aren't impacts. I guess the whole issue is going to turn on the definition of unacceptable impacts. And of course, we have our view about what's unacceptable, and we're hoping that the science will demonstrate to Ms. Bomar that even the levels that are there now are probably providing or contributing to unacceptable impacts.
We're talking with Bill Wade, who is the Executive Council Chairman of the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees, about the recent confirmation of Mary Bomar as the new Director of National Parks. Well, Bill, let's say that you could sit down in a private conversation with Mary Bomar and just lay it on the table. What would you say to the new National Park Director?
Well, I would certainly first of all tell her that she is held in very, very high regard by the employees of the National Park System, and that they are very hopeful and are very excited and energized by the fact that she's become director, and that she needs to make sure that they're valued, that their judgment and experience is used and considered, unlike has been the case in the last six or so years. I would also advise her that she needs to very strongly consider science and research in decision making in parks, and in considering those decisions that come to her level about uses and protections of parks and so forth. I would also advise her to continue the emphasis on partnerships and so forth, but to be very careful that that is done in a way that preserves the nationalness of national parks and preserves the fact that almost all of the functions of the national park system ought to be public and not privatized. And I guess lastly, I would suggest that she do everything she can to provide a compelling case to the Congress that parks are important to the American public, and that they need to be funded at a level that resources will not be damaged and will not deteriorate over time. And I think if she carries out those things, she will go down in history as a good director.
Well, coming from the Executive Council Chairman of the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees, which represents thousands and thousands of years worth of professional park experience, I think the new park director would be wise to keep an open ear. Bill Wade, tell us how people can find out more about your organization.
We do have a website. It is www.npsretirees, all one word, .org. And we do have information there about the issues and action issues that we're concerned about and actions that we've taken over the recent past. And we would invite people to go there and learn a little bit more about us.
Well, Bill Wade, it's always good to talk with you, and it's so great to have you give me your thoughts here on the Wild Side News.
Good. Thank you again for asking me. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.
You bet. Bye.
Well, it's probably time to lighten up a little, as we do just that, as we migrate out to Great Smoky Mountains National Park and follow the monarchs on their fall flights. We'll be right back.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We're staying in our national parks for the rest of the show, although the story we're about to follow takes us on a long journey across many states and even beyond our borders. But it all begins in one of America's most scenic parks. We're off to study butterfly migration in the Great Smoky Mountains National Parks of Tennessee. It's a flight of fancy, which we all need on a regular basis, when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News. Everyone at some time has heard the legend that monarch butterflies migrate thousands of miles each fall and spring. There's probably a good percentage of people who've tucked that factoid amongst the other suburban legends. After all, how could a butterfly actually take such a journey? You're about to find out. Fall is in the air, and it's a time for change, and a lot of creatures are having to look at what's coming up, and what that means for most creatures in North America is winter. Most animals that are on their own try to figure out how to adapt. Many go into hibernation. Some decide to get out of Dodge and head to warmer climates. And there's some legendary tales about that, particularly as we watch the fall migration of birds. But there's a wonderful story that we're all familiar with, but we're going to go a little more in-depth on that, and that is the miraculous migrations of monarch butterflies. It's an astonishing story, and to help interpret that at a much greater depth, we're now joined by Jason Love, who is the citizen scientist with the Great Smoky Mountains Institute in Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Jason, welcome to the Wildside News.
Well, thank you for having me.
First of all, talk about the Great Smoky Mountains Institute and what you do and how that actually works in partnership with national parks.
Right. We're a nonprofit organization. We partner with the park, and we mainly focus with school groups. So we're a residential environmental education center, and schools can spend from 3 to 5 days here in a national park, and they're out every day exploring the trails, exploring the streams, doing all sorts of interesting natural history investigations. We also have summer programs, and we have field ecology camp that's targeted to 13 to 17-year-olds where we work with scientists and do real research. We also have a discovery camp for younger students, ages 9 to 13, and natural expeditions camp, ages 11 to 13. So we have a whole bunch of stuff going on. We also have adult programs. And so every week, something is happening, whether it's in the school year or in the summer.
As you say, it's a residential camp, so people come and stay for days.
Correct.
Oftentimes in some sort of dormitory, I suppose.
Right.
And it's an extraordinary opportunity. In terms of your school groups, most of them, I'm sure, are coming from your local area, but let's say someone from Massachusetts decided that they would like to visit the park. Is that possible?
Oh, yes. We've had groups come from as far away as Miami, Florida, Michigan. So all of our information is on the web, www.gsmit.org. And you can find any information, and there's a phone number there if you want to schedule a trip here.
Well, there's a really interesting program that you're working on right now, because that's the way science works. You have to do it when it's possible. And this is that you're involved in a program in association with MonarchWatch.com, which is you're tagging monarch butterflies. Why don't you give us the science behind your project?
This started a while ago. There was no one knew when the monarchs migrated. So finally, a scientist, I believe it wasn't until the 1970s, that a tagged monarch was finally found in Mexico, and they discovered that was where the eastern monarchs were migrating and spending the winter. Since then, there's been concern about the monarch migration. Although monarchs are still fairly common, there is concern that their wintering grounds are being impacted by logging, and also their summer grounds in North America are being impacted by habitat degradation. There's some concern of the ozone damage that the milkweed is susceptible to that's causing mortality to the milkweed. And then just weed eaters and herbicides for the milkweed. Some people consider it a weedy species. So because of that, this Monarch Watch program was started up. And so it allows citizens and scientists to tag monarchs to kind of see what their population dynamics are doing and kind of determine their survivorship and how many of these monarchs are actually reaching their wintering grounds.
How long has the Institute been involved in this project?
The Institute has been involved approximately since 1995.
Oh, wow.
They started, we had a naturalist here that started tagging on her own, and from that it's kind of grown every year. I started in April. And the person in my position, Michelle Prisby, her master's work was on the monarch butterfly, so she expanded it from there and did studies on monarch larvae and other aspects of the monarch. So
you actually have some real numbers in terms of the population's increases, decreases. I think it was within the last 2 years there was a serious impact in Mexico,
right,
and the numbers went down. Were you able to be aware of that from your studies there?
We could see it. I mean, last year we only caught a few dozen species, and already this year we've caught 67 monarchs, and the season's just now peaking. So people I've talked to from previous years, this is my first time doing it, but people have said that this year is a really good year for tagging monarchs.
Mm-hmm.
in the park.
It's amazing the fecundity of the creatures, the capacity to come back even after these impacts. It's a bit of a mystery from a scientific perspective. Well, talk too about some of the specifics of the monarch butterflies. There's sort of two different flyways and destinations. Why don't you talk about that life cycle throughout the year?
Right. Well, the monarchs in the east spend their winters in the Transvolcanic Mountains of Mexico. It's about 2 miles high in elevation, so they're not really warm there, but it does offer some form of protection. Starting in, I want to say, about February, they start slowly migrating north, and as the milkweed blooms or comes up, the monarchs start laying their eggs on that milkweed. That generation will then die, and then the next generation will go a little bit further north. And so this continues until about 3 to 5 generations later. The monarchs then return to Mexico. So it's usually the third. It depends on where the monarchs get to, but it's usually the third to fifth generation of monarchs that actually returns to the Transvolcanic Mountains. Now, if you're in the western part of the country, a lot of those monarchs go to the coast of California and overwinter.
Well, the amazing thing about that is the fact that these little tiny creatures that are so delicate and can be tossed around in the wind end up making over a 3,000-mile migration. It actually is difficult to understand, first of all, how in the world they're able to do that, but it also raises some rather fascinating questions related to, here you take an individual, just like a bird, but in this little tiny insect brain is the knowledge, number one, that it's time to go, number two, the direction to go, depending on what season it is. They head south in the winter, and they find that spot, which again is a mystery, and then they overwinter, and then they head north in the spring again. There's a lot of information going on there in the insect mind, and it's one of the great stories in the natural world.
Right. Scientists are still puzzled how they do it. Birds, I mean, they have other flocks to follow sometimes, or have been there. This is a butterfly that is a couple generations removed from its wintering ground. So how does it know how to get there? Science is still a puzzle of how all this information is packed and how it does it. It's a miracle of nature that science are still trying to figure out.
When I was in college, I actually worked on some of the original research on monarch butterfly migration. We were studying primarily what caused the butterfly to migrate. One of the things that happens is the fact that the butterfly has to go through some literal body changes. In order to make this flight, it has to have the energy to do so, because it doesn't really feed along the way very much, and so it has to put on a tremendous amount of fat, which is the energy to get it down there. As well, other things have to happen. They want to travel light, so male testes just disappear during that time. We ultimately determined was the fact that these hormonal changes were inspired by a change, lengthening and decreasing in the daylight, and that actually creates these hormonal changes. So it's really quite astonishing. Well, I'm curious now, in terms of how you go about the tagging, what's involved?
Well, we send out a letter to our volunteers. We have a bunch of citizen scientists that regularly come to Tremont to do some of our science projects in the park. We send out a mass email to folks and let them know it's time of year again to tag monarchs. The actual tagging process involves catching a monarch, determining whether it's a male or female. The males have a little pouch on the upper hind wing, and that's how you can tell the males apart. And then we simply grab a sticker. It's no bigger, smaller than a dime, and place that sticker on the underside of the hind wing in a particular cell. And that sticker has a unique code, and we can then look up that code later. If recovery folks in Mexico can look that number up and can say, okay, this is number HCZ133, and they look it up and say, okay, this came from Case Cove, Great Smoky Mountain. So that's basically how the tagging works, just a simple sticker, nothing complex.
Let's say that I'm a volunteer, and I show up and I want to participate. What do you give me, a butterfly net?
We give you a butterfly net. Before we let you use it, we kind of go through the proper techniques of handling a butterfly net. We then talk about safety issues. This time of year, the yellow jackets are out. They're a little ornery this time of year, so we warn people about that. That's the only time it's a good time to run if you step in a yellow jacket nest. Then we just go over the tagging. One of the naturalists in this area actually raises monarchs, and she'll bring some out to the park, and people will get a first-hand look of how to gently take that monarch out of the net and then the process of tagging. So we cover all that within the first 30 minutes of people arriving.
So then I head out, and are there locations that you direct me to, or do I just kind of head out on my own?
Right. We have specific locations that we try to go to. There's about 3 to 4 fields in Cades Cove. Cades Cove, for folks who aren't who haven't been to the Snake Mountains, Cades Cove is in the western part of the park, and it's a cove, a remarkably flat valley with mountains all around it. It has a limestone geology, and because of that, this area was farmed. And so the park still maintains it in meadows of various successional stages. So it's a great place to find monarchs coming in and nectaring on thistles, sometimes goldenrod. So that's where we target the monarch tag, and we have a couple old fields that we go to.
How long typically do the monarchs migrate through?
We have tagged monarchs as late as middle of November. So there are some still trickling through. Right now is the peak time for tagging monarchs, but they will trickle through all on into November.
Now, back in Mexico, when they when they pick up one of your monarchs, what's the feedback in terms of how long that journey takes?
Usually it takes a couple months for the actual monarch to arrive in Mexico. And we can then go to the Monarch Watch site, and we can type in our names as the ones who tagged the monarch. And then if a recovery person in Mexico actually finds the tag, our names will show up on that list, and there's a certificate that the taggers receive if their monarch makes it all the way to Mexico. So it's kind of a neat way to connect people, particularly a kid, to the monarch migration. It's just kind of the wondrous miracle of the monarch.
So fascinating.
Kids get really, really neat, particularly if they can get a certificate in the mail saying, hey, remember that monarch you tagged back in October? Well, it's January now, and it's found its way to Mexico.
Oh, that would be really, really exciting for anybody, really.
Yeah,
because you've kind of gone on that journey with them.
Right.
You know? Now, in Mexico, when they get a monarch like that, then do they record the information and re-release the butterfly?
They do record the information and let the butterfly go on its way. So they don't re-tag it, can see the tag, write down that number, and then release it.
So conceivably, you could actually see that butterfly passing through your area in the spring again.
Correct, yeah. There is a possibility that could happen.
I'm not
aware of anything. In the park, we've only had one monarch, and this was in 2001. One monarch from the park was found and recovered in the Transvolcanic Mountains. So that was pretty exciting, because when we started this project, folks didn't think there were monarchs here in the Cades Cove, or at least not in numbers that would justify having a monarch tagging project in the park. I mean, in some areas, the monarchs are much more numerous. The Smoky Mountains are not a major flyway for the monarchs, but we do get them. So it just comes to show that, you know, you think you might know something, but once you actually start it, you find out new things. So monarchs are here. They are in decent numbers in the park, and they're making it to Mexico.
Now, this actually is a nationwide program, monarchwatch.com, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So people all over the country can participate as they want as a volunteer.
Right, and it's a great project. It's one of my favorite citizen science projects because it's relatively easy to ID a monarch compared to the other butterflies. Once you see one, your eye is focused on that. It's easy to differentiate the sexes, and then it's easy to capture them and tag them. So you don't have to be, your last initials don't have to be PhD to do something like that.
Now,
anybody can do it.
I'm in California. If I wanted to participate, I would contact Monarch Watch, and do they actually provide then stickers or something like that?
Right. You do have to pay a fee for the stickers. I believe, I want to say ours, we got 200 stickers, and I believe that was around $40, give or take a couple bucks.
Mm-hmm. I'm always looking for another excuse to get outside, and what a great way to spend some time in the fall and in the spring, out catching butterflies with a purpose. That's a great thing to do.
Yeah, it's neat. And most people haven't caught butterflies before, so we do target all species of butterflies, and it also helps us create a list for the park that we GPS those points and the park can use as well. So we're focused in on monarchs, but if it's a slow day, there's always other butterflies, and students and adults learn about other butterflies in the area too.
One of the things that people don't think about as much as they possibly should when they think about national parks, and that is the institutes and the opportunity to really do real research and science. And there's any number of opportunities throughout the national park system. And obviously what's happening at the Great Smoky Mountains Institute is just an example of the great things that people can do as part of the national park system.
Right. Yeah, it's important to get involved. It's your national park, and with budget cuts, citizens are becoming more important in collecting data. So this is a great project. You think of the Christmas bird count and the breeding bird survey, other projects that citizens have gotten involved with and actually made some really good data that scientists can then publish on. So this is in that same vein, the Monarch Watch. So it is definitely a good project for folks to get involved with.
Now, in just a little bit different vein, tell me what's happening in Great Smoky Mountains right now. If you were out to be there, what would I be experiencing?
Right now, today is a fairly warm day. It's in the 70s. The leaves are starting to turn. The sourwood trees are turning red. Some of the other trees are just now starting to yellow. Peak color won't be here till a couple weeks. Right now, we have a school group out that are going on a geology hike to the Spruce Flats Falls. There are some threats to the park right now, invasive exotic species. One of the things that we're most worried about is the loss of our eastern hemlock trees. We have the hemlock woolly adelgid, a species that was brought from Asia, and it is killing our hemlock trees. So right now, when I look out the window, I see the hemlocks, and they look healthy right now, but I know that in the next couple years, that picture could change. So things are always changing the park, some for the better and some for the worse, but right now the hemlocks are green. That could change next year.
Well, one of the most fantastic parks, there's so many great parks, but one of the really great ones is the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So, Jason, if people want to, again, find out about the Institute, give them that website.
The website is www.gsmit.org.
Jason Love, citizen scientist with the Great Smoky Mountains Institute. I want to thank you for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Hey, thank you, Sydney. Enjoyed it.
Do whatever it takes to keep your national parks yours so that the wonders will forever be ours. Next week, we're doing a vision quest to the new Earth Park that's about to take shape, bring you updates on the elusive ivory-billed woodpecker, which may or may not be hiding in Florida, and, well, you'll just have to tune in next Thursday or any day on the archives when your voice of the earth calls out around the world. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News.